I've seen this movie.
Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello, and thanks for joining the program today. Over the last couple of weeks, we've been discussing a slogan in Namkhar Pal's text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, that reads, Don't maintain inverted loyalty. In other translations, it has read, Avoid, yet practice getting tough. Don't be so predictable. Don't rely on consistency. Don't devote yourself kindly to the central object. And do not be hindbound by a sense of duty, amongst others. Although in his commentary, Namkhar Pal specifically points to this slogan, meaning not holding a grudge, we've seen from other commentaries that it also refers to not being loyal to any of the afflictive emotions, and especially self-cherishing. It's our natural tendency to identify with, make sense of, and follow whatever emotion arises, and thus create our own and others' suffering through negative actions like holding grudges and so on. This slogan tells us our loyalty to our negative emotions is misplaced. And you might remember that His Holiness the Dalai Lama covers the different interpretations when he says, this has two different interpretations. In some commentaries, it means not to allow the major road in our minds to lead in the direction of disturbing attitudes. According to other commentaries, this means that when we see someone, our minds generally go straight to that person as if on a major thoroughfare. This second interpretation, as explained in these commentaries, is that, for instance, when someone upsets us, we must not let our minds go straight to that person with thoughts of holding a grudge. I think the first interpretation is probably a little bit easier to understand, that we need to avoid letting the main direction of our mind lead towards disturbing attitudes. That is His Holiness. And with this, and the aid of many other commentators, we have covered the slogan quite fully. And now I think we can move on to the next, which is, don't make malicious banter. However, before we do that, let's check our motivation for participating in the program as we usually do. If it's not bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment to benefit all beings, let's bring that into play. But if it is already bodhicitta, we can be happy and rejoice. So let's take a moment to see what's driving us. Thanks very much. And now, don't make malicious banter. I don't know what the original word translated here as banter is, but it seems a little odd. Other translations are, don't malign others, don't be excited by cutting remarks, and don't laugh at malicious jokes. I guess you get the idea that malice is the operative word here, and we will come to those other translations. But Namkhar Pal's commentary tells us not to speak abusively in a way that strikes at the heart of anyone who hears it. The esteemed Chikawa explains this as saying such things as, at the time you committed that offense, I did not respond. It is not clear whether this has been done or not, and so forth. Pouring out a stream of such invective will ruin the seeds of your practice. Now again, I'm also not sure what it is not clear whether this has been done or not refers to, but I guess it has some intention to put another person down for something they've done. I suppose banter can come under the heading of maliciously denigrating someone else. It does very easily tread the line between great friendliness and jokey insult. Some men, too afraid to express their affection, use a kind of insulting banter with their friends to convey what they feel. But if it is not understood in the spirit of the gift, it can be taken as malicious and cause a lot of upset. Evidently in Ireland, it's common for men to insult each other as an expression of fondness. In The Independent, on www.independent.ie, the writer Anton Savage, in an article, Slagging is so much part of what we do, we find it odd when someone objects, cogently writes about this. Although he's writing about the Irish, I think much of what he says applies to any culture where blokes use the technique, and we do sometimes in New Zealand. Now, I'm terrible at accents, so I'm not going to attempt the Irish. So please be patient with the English, as Anton Savage writes. In America, positive reinforcement comes in clearly marked packages. Parents are told to tell their kids they are special and unique. Bosses are told to tell their staff how valuable they are and what a great contribution they make to the company. In Ireland, we've always tended to gift-wrapped our positives somewhat differently. We do it by insult. The closeness of Irish friendships, particularly Irish male friendships, can often be measured by how egregiously the friends insult each other. Incompetence, ineptitude with the opposite sex, shortness, tallness, fatness, skinniness, hairiness, and baldness are all highlighted to tighten the bonds of mutual affection. A few other cultures do that. In Ireland, a salesman can tell his team he's finally landed a big client, and the team will say, "Glad to see you finally pulled your thumb out, Mick." But Mick will know what's meant is, "We're proud of you." We undermine each other to reinforce each other. At least we used to. The one area that we've never really been sure how to handle is race. You can slag your pal for being short, but slagging him for being black or Asian or Hispanic tends to be off limits. There are exceptions. A documentary a number of years ago featured an Irishman of Asian extraction who told a story of being in a pub where a guy in the bar kept glancing at him. Eventually, the Asian Irishman walked over and asked what the guy was looking at. "You're a queer-looking excuse for an Irishman," was the response. "Fancy a pint?" It was told as a story of how welcoming the Irish can be, not how racist we can be. A case this week highlighted that we haven't quite found the line where insult as compliment becomes insult as insult. A pipe fitter from the UK was awarded €20,000 because his Irish colleagues abused him. They read out negative football results about the English team in the World Cup, sang rebel songs, and wherever a dangerous job came up said, "Send the Brit in." The man took it all as personal assault. The people doing it probably believed their actions to be nationally acceptable. "We take pride in beating the English." Ray Horton is still a national hero because of his goal against England in Euro 88. Christy Moore even wrote a song calling Houghton's goal "Revenge for Skibbereen." Sure, it's only a bit of crake. We don't really mean any harm. Now, by crake, he obviously means the dictionary definition of fun or enjoyable conversation. He continues, "The problem is that what turns crake into insult is reaction, not intent. What matters is how the communication is received, not how it was intended. Many of us regularly cross the line of racism and insult deliberately and with good intentions, and find ourselves in a position where we depend on the reaction of the potential victim to define whether it's acceptable or not. I have friends who regularly ask their gay friends if they were picking out curtains recently. Catholic friends who keep telling their Protestant pals that they kick with the wrong foot. I even once worked with a group from a disability organization who referred to each other as cripples. In each case, the terms that are on the face of it brutally insulting were used to show affection, not rejection. In other words, behavior or terminology that one person may accept and even regard as positive can be another's abuse. In a workplace where rolling abuse is a big and positive part of the corporate culture, the presence of someone who finds it offensive means either they must be treated differently and thereby excluded, which in itself is not acceptable, or their entire culture must change. Changing a culture is difficult and can create its own set of resentments against the perceived catalyst of the change. That's why judgments, such as the one this week, may cause more trouble than they solve. The ideal result would be that people would feel sorry for the person who is abused. In reality, it's more likely that they'll blame the victim. They'll probably attribute intent. They'll think, "I bet they were only messing with him. Sure, I get called a Jackeen by my friends from Cork, and I call them langers. It was only messing, they didn't mean any harm." Now, oddly, intent is irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether an insult is intended to be malicious or affectionate. If it's perceived as hurtful, then it is. Because insulting each other is so much a part of what we do, we find it odd that someone could object. But lots of people find offensive what we find normal. A colleague of mine was recently at a two-day meeting in New York. Early on, he realized that one of the Americans in attendance was an obnoxious, distant, dislikable pain in the backside. But because he had to get the best out of him, he spent the first coffee break trying to establish what was wrong. Turned out to be simple. One word, Jesus. Every time my colleague said it, the American flinched because he regarded it as blasphemy. In a situation like that, there's no point trying to explain that Jesus is used by the Irish in a way that has shag all to do with a man upstairs. No point explaining that even Irish priests use Jesus willy-nilly. No amount of argument would change the American's mind about what he saw to be blasphemy. And no amount of argument will make someone who has been insulted or victimized think that it's just a bit of crack. And now that's the problem, isn't it? We have no real idea whether the recipient of our insulting banter is going to take it as expressing that we feel so free with him that it's an expression of our appreciation, or whether it's going to hit a nerve and we'll have a sulky argument on our hands. Even with people we are very close to, this is true. I have a close friend, and for a time we would make some derogatory remarks about each other, usually taking them in the jokey, affectionate spirit they were intended. But there have also been times that the insult has been ill-judged and caused some friction. And in the long run, it is really not worth it. It would be better to be straightforward, unambiguous, and gentle in speech. Which is really what Numcarpel is also advocating. Other commentaries don't talk about banter, but go straight to malicious speech. On www.tricycle.org, Judy Leaf, like so many other content commentators, accepts the much more direct translation, don't malign others, and says, when we malign someone, our intention is to cause harm. Our words are spiteful and ill-spirited. There's a saying that sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. But in fact, words do have power, and they certainly can hurt. In working with the slogans, we are working not only with our actions, but with what is behind them. For instance, when we say something, we should ask ourselves why we're saying it and for what purpose. Will what we say help the situation or not? Are we trying to connect with someone or get rid of them? Are we trying to help them or to destroy them? Or maybe we're just talking to talk, to fill the space, because we are uneasy with the silence. If we need to malign others to make us feel good about ourselves by comparison, we will never feel all that great. And at the other extreme, when we encounter people who are exceptional, that approach will make us feel pathetic in comparison. According to the slogan, we should stop that whole destructive approach. Not maligning does not mean that we do not notice differences in people. It does not mean that we should not recognize people's hateful or destructive attitudes and weaknesses when we encounter them, or that we should not speak up. Everything does not just become a mush. But when we see other people's problems without encumbering our perception by the need to prop up our own insecure ego, we can respond more directly and appropriately. By stopping the habit of maligning, not only will we do less to harm others, but we will also begin to free ourselves from the need for such props. And so says Judy Leaf. Chogyam Trungpa, in the Bodhisattva Path of Wisdom and Compassion, also uses the translation, don't malign others. But his commentary is more in line with the Irish banter, though without any pretense of affection. He sees maligning as actually malignant, even though it may come in a sweet package. He says, you would like to put people in the wrong by saying disparaging things. However pleasantly coated with sugar and ice cream, underneath you're trying to put people down. You think your virtue seems stronger when the virtues of other people are lessened, so you want to show that they are less virtuous than you. For instance, you might have better training in meditation, So you think, somebody else has a shorter attention span and shamatha practice than I do, therefore I am better. Or you may be well educated in the Dharma, so you think, somebody else knows fewer Dharma terms than I do, therefore I am better. Fundamentally, you are saying that other people are stupid and that you are better than them. You should not disparage or malign people in this way. And that is Chogyam Trungpa. His student, Pema Chodron, uses the same translation, don't malign others, in her commentary, Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living. However, for her, the coating of the disdain is not sugar or ice cream, it is gossip. She says, we put a lot of energy and time into gossiping about others. Perhaps there's somebody, maybe it's just one person that you have a problem with. Maybe it's Pearl, who's so pitiful. She's always feeling left out, and you find yourself reminded of your mother, who's also like that. Somehow Pearl and your mother become all mixed up together, and you find yourself continually irritated and disgusted by the pitifulness of Pearl, and it keeps triggering a lot of stuff in you. Yet you don't have the slightest interest in actually getting to know Pearl and finding out what's going on there. You have no desire to communicate with Pearl and find out who she is. Instead, there's some kind of satisfaction that you get from not liking her, and you spend a lot of time and energy talking to yourself about pitiful Pearl, or whoever it might be, horrible Horatio, or miserable Mortimer. And now, seeing we are talking about maligning others with gossip, here's a quite well-known story that crops up in various guises about the effects of gossip. I first heard it as a Mullah Nasruddin story, but here it's in a form of a rhyme titled Feathers, and I've taken it off the webpage titled Wisdom Stories to Live By on philipchirkob.wordpress.com, and it goes like this. A woman whose tongue was sharp and unkind was accused of starting a rumor. She was brought before the village rabbi protesting. What I said was just in jest, just humor. My words were carried forth by others. I'm not to blame. But the victim cried for justice, saying, you've soiled my good name. I can make amends, said the woman accused. I'll just take back my words and assume I'm excused. The rabbi listened to what she said, and sadly thought, as he shook his head, this woman does not comprehend her crime. She shall do it again and again in time. And so he said to the woman accused, your careless words cannot be excused until you bring my feather pillow to the market square. Cut it, and let the feathers fly through the air. When this task is done, bring me back the feathers, every one. The woman reluctantly agreed. She thought, the wise old rabbi has gone mad indeed. But to humor him, she took his pillow to the village square. She cut it and feathers filled the air. She tried to catch, she tried to snatch, she tried to collect each one. But weary with effort, she clearly discovered the task could not be done. She returned with very few feathers in hand. I couldn't get them back, they're scattered over the land. I suppose, she sighed as she lowered her head, like the words I can't take back from the rumor I spread. Now, when we gossip about others, especially in a nasty way, do we even think how far our words, like chicken feathers in the wind, will spread? Or how once the words have left our mouth, they can never be taken back? As we've seen many times, maligning others is especially harmful and irretrievable in our today's environment of all-pervasive social media. Put something nasty about someone else on Facebook or any of the other social media platforms, and it can spread like wildfire and cause such terrible damage that the victim may feel forced to commit suicide. What makes it even more reprehensible is that one can do it anonymously and so not be forced, like the woman in the poem, to take responsibility for the action. Yet you cannot escape karma, and in due course, the malignancy will return with a much more virulent sting in its tail for you. On the website www.everup.com, Wendy Rose Gould examines our tendencies to gossip in an article titled Psychology of Gossip and What It Reveals About Our Sense of Self. She writes, somewhere right now, in the office next door on your cell phone, some gossiping is going down. It happens all the time. so frequently that you may not even realize how often it permeates your conversations. We exchanged details on Bob and Kathy's rendezvous during last night's happy hour at the Fora office water cooler. We lean in and spill all the details we overheard coming from the boss's office to our co-workers at lunch. We repeat the rumor we heard about a friend the minute she leaves the room. What exactly compels us to talk about others with such fervency? Is it a source of self-satisfaction? Are we satiating an inherent need? And while it's generally seen as a negative interaction, is there any benefit to taking part? Human beings are social beings and often depend on others as if they are psychological tuning forks to fine-tune ourselves. We are constantly adapting ourselves to our changing environments, modern-day challenges, and daring social, technical, and cultural advancements, says Lorraine Fontale, a licensed clinical psychologist based in Berkeley, California. But even when this wasn't the case, our minds were continuously stretched by the sheer differences that existed within one household or village that had little contact with the outside, despite extreme pressure at times for conformity. In the most favorable light, she explained, gossiping provides humans with the opportunity to compare ourselves to others, to examine where we fit in the grand mosaic of human behavior. Fontale acknowledged that what on one hand is a natural inclination for self-comparison can also be extremely detrimental when it comes to our relationships. Gossiping can create a divide between friends, family, peers, or within social groups. So why, knowing the harm it can cause to ourselves and others, are we so drawn to the pastime? It turns out there are numerous reasons. For starters, gossiping can create a sense of self-importance for the gossiper, like he or she is privy to information that others aren't, elevating them in status. If the listener is enthralled by the gossip, then gossiping becomes highly rewarding and is likely to be reinforced, says Paul Coleman, a psychologist and the author of Finding Peace When Your Heart Is in Pieces. Another factor, says Coleman, is that it makes people feel better about themselves or their own lives to say something negative about someone else. This is a classic case of trying to diminish your own pain, anxiety, and worry by drawing attention to another person. In that same sense, gossiping can be a form of projection, explained Fontale. For example, someone may talk about another's promiscuity or the way someone interacts with their family. In that critique, the gossiper may be subconsciously projecting feelings they have about their own sexuality or familial relations onto someone else. Wendy Rose Gould goes on to say that the most common gossiping is a form of superficial social bonding with a message, you are important to me and the other person is less important. Coleman links it to our earliest days of creating social groups, where gossip would keep some people in the loop, as it were, and others not so desirable, out. People who gossip a great deal may need to feel the pseudo-connection because other ways of relating are not as effective, he says. Gold admits it may be a form of quasi-bonding, but ultimately creates an ugly veneer of distrust. The listener, she says, likely walks away wondering what the gossiper says behind his or her back. Also, Coleman says, people with very gossipy friends eventually realize that the friendship is not so firm and that their relationship was held together by the false intimacy that comes from gossiping about others. Gould says while gossip may leave with a feeling of connection, there are better ways of creating stronger bonds without the nasty and ever-present potential harms of gossiping. Gossip is regarded in Buddhism as one of the 10 non-virtues, implying it is never good. But Coleman posits a situation where it can be useful if it's not at the expense of someone else. I can envision situations where it can be helpful and not harmful, he says. For example, a new co-worker is intimidated by the boss. You tell the co-worker something personal about the boss that isn't malicious, that might help the person be less intimidated. Like, our boss is having some problems with his kids, so he's more irritable lately. Don't take his harshness personally. This kind of gossip might even forge real bonds and strengthen relationships. And what should you do if gossip about someone else turns nasty? Gently change the topic, says Coleman. Or if the gossip has to do with a personal problem the gossiper has with the person they're talking about, suggest a one-to-one conversation with that person. If it does burn a bridge between you and the gossiper, then take comfort in knowing you were never protected from being gossiped about yourself anyway, he says. Gould says we often use gossip as a crutch to form bonds in uncomfortable situations where there's not much to talk about. But Coleman says it would be better to ask sincere questions about things important to those with whom we are talking. He says, for example, how did your son's school play go? How do you like your new car? Have you found a design for your new kitchen yet? Use these answers to spur follow-up questions, which, if delivered genuinely, can show real interest and help facilitate that bond. Another way is to do something together that is fun, he says. Yes, going out to lunch or dinner is fine, but research shows we tend to bond more quickly with people when we experience a lot of laughter with them, and go to a comedy club together, share some emotional event, an uplifting movie or play, or when our heart rate goes up, a jog together, go to an amusement park and ride the roller coaster. While engaged in the experience of a fun activity, the blowout fight you overheard between your cubicle mate and her husband will be the last thing on your mind. So, plan some fun times with your co-workers and leave the water cooler talk to sports results and the like. And that is where we must leave the program today. Thanks very much for being with us, and please tune in again next time. Also, before we go, let's dedicate any positive energy from our time together to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you very much, and fare ye well.
is a member of CARMA, the Community Access Media Alliance. Find out more at CAA.